quite often I say is that we not only need to focus on how do we prevent misuse of data, but also we need to start thinking about how do we prevent the missed uses of data.
Welcome to Leading the Shift, a podcast from Microsoft Azure, where we hear from the people at the forefront of data, AI, and cloud technologies. I'm your host, Susan Ettlinger. Hey, everyone. Welcome back. Okay, so we all know that data fuels AI. And we also know that the collection of technologies that we refer to as AI are among the most significant, powerful that we have seen in our lifetimes. And we also know that we as a human species have quite a number of challenges that we want to and we need to learn more about and we need to work on. And here's the kicker, is that a lot of the data that we need in order to be able to better understand those challenges is extremely confidential. And I'm talking about things like our health, data that describe our cities, our children, so many different areas. And so I don't think it would be an overstatement to say that our guest today has spent a significant portion of his professional life thinking about these issues, both as a professor at NYU in the engineering school and also as the co-founder and chief research and development officer of the GovLab. And so I'm thrilled to introduce Stefan Verhulst to have this conversation today. Stefan, thank you so much and welcome.
Thanks so much, Susan, for having me.
Yeah, no, it's my pleasure. So let's get into it. I feel like I gave sort of like a child's crayon drawing of this issue and your background. So could you help kind of fill in the colors a little bit?
Yeah, so I mean, you were right to say that I've spent quite some time thinking about how we, on the one hand, can leverage data for public interest purposes, such as improving healthcare or such as how do we manage cities in a much better way, but also, of course, been doing a lot of thinking on how to do so in a responsible way. Because as you said, Susan, a lot of the data that we can and should use to a large extent is personally identifiable and also needs to be protected in ways that, of course, aligns with people's expectations and preferences. And so that's the real challenge of today's data age. On the one hand, we have massive amounts of data. On the other hand, a lot of that data is not accessible or needs to be protected in ways that means that they need to be constrained with regard to who has access to it, for what purposes, and so on. And that's the kind of the focus area that I've spent a lot of time on, both in terms of, as I said, thinking about how do we govern it, but also in terms of how do we make sure that we actually do use data in ways that can benefit society. Quite often I say is that we not only need to focus on how do we prevent misuse of data, but also we need to start thinking about how do we prevent the missed uses of data, because data can, to a large extent, help society. But as said, we need to do it in a responsible way.
Yeah, you remind me of this idea of food deserts, right? I mean, we have data deserts too, right? There are places where we just simply don't have access or the data doesn't exist. So, you know, I'd love you to just sort of paint a picture of this idea of data use and reuse and sort of what is the scope of issues as we start thinking about these consequential problems that we want to solve and some of the data challenges that we come across.
Yeah, so, well, first of all, as I said, digitalization, which we didn't realize at the beginning when we started talking about digital transformation, but digitalization basically has led to this massive datafication. Everything that has a digital component automatically creates a digital trail as well. And so as we have moved into kind of a digital environment where, anyway, we use ways to pay in a digital format. We take a bike and we have a digital trail because we have to lock in using our phone, for instance, or we are just making a call, which automatically means that there is a digital trail. All this information, to a large extent, is now being generated and collected at a scale that we've never seen before. Now, the unique characteristics of digital data is that we can actually start using that data that was initially collected for one purpose, we can start reusing it for other purposes. For instance, data that was collected to make a call, which meant that there was a signal going to an antenna, and then the antenna redirected that call to the other phone that you tried to reach. Well, that data can be used to understand urban mobility patterns. It can understand how people are moving around in cities. It can understand exactly where you should actually have more public transportation, because we see that most people are in this zone, but the public transportation is in that zone. And so how do we make sure that we match it? So we can see a lot of the data collected for one purpose can now be used for other purposes as well, which is unique about digital data. Now, at the same time, of course, when we do this, we also have to make sure that this aligns with people's expectations and preferences. And that's the real challenge, again, with regard to digital data, is that there's a massive potential, but there are also key governance challenges that we need to address. And we need to do this in ways that aligns with community and people's expectations.
Right, right. And we've seen this issue over and over again on the commercial side of things. And of course, in the public sector, it's essentially the same thing. How do you actually use data that was originally created for a particular purpose or created as a byproduct of a particular process? And, you know, imagine the other ways that you can use it in productive ways. And then by doing that, ensure that you're protecting the interests and the expectations and the best, I guess, outcomes for the people whose lives that data describes. And it's a tricky thing. So how would you say the issues of data reuse are different in the public sector from in the private sector? Or maybe they're just the same?
Well, they are kind of the same, especially when it comes to personally identifiable information. But of course, some information should be shared, because within the public sector, of course, there is this belief that a lot of the data was collected for the public and with public money, taxpayers' money. And also the belief is, of course, that that should then be made available for the public. Mm. And I think that's a real kind of important premise that has led, of course, to kind of the open data, especially open government data kind of movement, where there was a real call, not only for opening up data for accountability reasons, but also opening up data because, that data could be reused for instance, making better decisions at the individual level, at the organizational level, or even spur new companies to be created as a result of making that data available. Now, at the private level or private sector level, of course, that's a different story. At the same time, I do also feel that corporations also have a responsibility, because ultimately they have a social license to operate with regard to how they start stewarding that data in ways that not only benefit internal objectives, but also could, to a large extent, serve societal objectives as well. And I think that's the real interesting field that we are currently in, which is really about how do we make sure that data that was collected for administrative purposes, such as in governments, or for purposes to deliver better customer service, how do we start thinking about this as an asset that also can, to a large extent, help solve societal problems in ways that we didn't anticipate. Now, this has, of course, changed as a result of AI as well in a variety of ways. One way it has changed is that now what we typically thought about data, which was kind of a narrow sense of tabular data or structured data or semi-structured data that was collected in kind of a particular way, now, of course, we can start making sense of unstructured data or language data to a large extent that we didn't anticipate. And so the concept of data has become broader. It now includes video. It now includes audio. It includes unstructured text. It includes archival material. And so now the real opportunity is to how do we also make sense and have access to that data in ways that we can actually use to train, for instance, models that then subsequently can be used to, for instance, provide really localized decision support or better decision support with regard to particular kind of societal challenges.
Yeah, no, it's really interesting as you're talking. I'm really thinking about an episode that we did actually at the very beginning, which was entitled "Your Proprietary Data is Your Competitive Advantage." Not surprisingly, that was a more of a set of commercial uses, right? About organizational data essentially being the key to an organization's ability to develop, you know, to innovate, to develop novel products and services, to solve challenges that had not been solved before, and so on and so forth. And the incentives there are fairly clear, right? But the incentives, you know, going back to the point that you made about organizational responsibility, that some of that data also has potential to be used for the public good. Like it feels as though there's a bit of a conflicting imperative, or potentially a bit of friction there around how do we figure out which data is uniquely sort of usable for our own business, and how and what is our responsibility and what is our comfort level in making data available to the broader public. And I think, you know, that sort of mirrors the individual's issue in a way around, you know, for example, anytime you go to the doctor and they make you or ask you to sign something that says, you know, would you be willing to use your data to participate in a research study? Now we're talking about that in such a much broader canvas. So it really brings up so many different ways of thinking about kind of the individual responsibility, the organizational responsibility, and how we can kind of square these various different kinds of imperatives and ambitions that organizations and people have to share their data for public good. It seems fundamental to me.
Yeah. And I think what you mentioned, Susan, as well is right, that we have to start thinking also not only about, anyway, this is good for society, but also what's the business case? Because otherwise, it's very hard to sustain this. I mean, I've worked on this for quite a while now. And then the initial idea was that, anyway, this is a corporate social responsibility topic. But unfortunately, if it's just corporate social responsibility, then it doesn't become systematic, nor is it sustained for the long term as well. And so we've done a lot of work working with corporations on really thinking about what is actually the business case for providing access to your data for public interest purposes. Now, obviously, I totally agree with you, Susan, is that you don't want to share some of that data because it is your competitive edge. But for societal purposes, it could actually make total sense that you start providing that data. And so we developed something called the 9 R's, which are 9 reasons why corporations actually would provide access to their data for public interest purposes. And it starts, I'm not going to go through all the 9 R's, but it starts with ultimately, for instance, reciprocity. The fact that if you provide access to your data, you actually can also have access to other data that you might not have, or expertise that you might not have in-house. And so that makes total sense from a business perspective. Other reasons that are very, very compelling quite often is that by making your data open, you can actually outsource R&D in ways that you didn't anticipate. For instance, during COVID-19, there was a lot of data that was made available, and then it was shared with academics who made sense and developed models to make sense of their data in ways that they didn't anticipate. And they subsequently basically then ingested that model in their own organization for their own operations, making their own operations more efficient, or even be able to actually, for commercial use, start charging for that kind of use. And so you can see making data open can actually also be make sense from an R&D perspective, because you can actually get other eyes on your data that might generate value that you otherwise wouldn't expect. And so there are many other incentives. And I still, anyway, when I started working on this, Susan, I always, when I say, well, I'm working on, how private sector can start providing access to some of that data, most of the time people were looking at me as if I was the most naive person in the room, which typically it is. But at the same time, you can see that actually there are business cases for doing so. And now with actually AI, businesses need a lot more data than they actually have in-house.
Yeah.
And so we are at this moment where reciprocity, right? I provide access to my data, but then I also have access to other data, makes even more sense than it was ever before, which means that we actually do need to move to this kind of collective kind of data sets that actually benefits more than just one organization as well.
Yeah. And so that, of course, raises the question of, well, how do you do that? Like, how do you actually, those sound like very delicate negotiations, both at this discrete organization level and then sort of more broadly, industry associations, governments, you know, and industries and so on.
Yeah, well, so that's where, anyway, a few years ago, I coined this concept and the practice of data collaborations, which is really kind of a new partnership model where different data holders working together to have access to data for reuse. And that can, anyway, and there are multiple versions of that. There's no one way of doing that. And sometimes it's multiple data holders, sometimes it's one data holder, sometimes it's multiple users, sometimes it's one user or one use case. But it suffice to say is that this is feasible, both at the level of technology, because I think that's actually probably the easiest part of data collaboration, but also at the level of governance, because to a large extent, this is really a governance question, right? Which is, how do you govern access? How do you govern what use cases are appropriate for the data? And how do you govern in a way that people trust how you go about actually providing access to that data? And so one of the models that we more recently have started working on, because of the new kinds of data that is made or should be made available, and also because of the use case with regard to AI, is of course this concept of data commons, which is a new or at least a renewed interest in how data, including, for instance, large language data, can be made available in ways that are governed in alignment with communities' expectations and preferences, hence commons. And I think that's the real, interesting opportunity now, is to really spur innovation in data commons, because everyone is now hungry for more data, needs more data, and more importantly, we need far more high-quality data that is very unique in order to inform and make very contextual, specific AI applications. Mm. And that will require access to kind of new data sources that can be made available through data commons. And so that's kind of data commons. It's kind of a new version of data collaboratives that is kind of more ready for the AI age, because it focuses on high-quality data, focuses also on AI-ready data, and it focuses on a particular way of governing access to that data in ways that is not extractive, but actually aligns with expectations from those that will either benefit or be harmed on how that data is being used.
So let's click down into that a little bit. So give us a couple of examples, like what would be a project or type of project, and feel free to anonymize if you need to. Little bit of stuff going on in the background. Never mind that. Anyway, so what would be, what would be some examples of how you might do that?
Yeah. So there are multiple examples, and I'm not gonna particularly mention the concrete names, because otherwise it's gonna be like winners that are being identified here. But for instance, if you want to do localized decision support at times of crisis, right? Then you actually need high quality data that, for instance, that embeds case studies on how previous crises have been handled, right? Within that particular kind of locality, either successful or not successful. You need high quality data with regard to points of interest, where they are, and how they can be activated at the times of crisis. And so that typically is very hard to get. Typically in the past, basically was laying in archives or in boxes that, I mean, no one had figured out how to use it to actually really extract insight so that we can do things better and more effectively. And that's the kind of, anyway, data commons environments that is super exciting, where you can actually extract insight from, for instance, case studies on how, or after crisis reports, for instance, that that really have identified how things worked, and you can use that for very localized decision support when a crisis hits. That's just one example. There are other examples where you can start leveraging data about, anyway, agricultural data on what seeds and what plants grow best in what kind of soil, right? Because it turns out that a lot of kind of farmers, especially globally, quite often, anyway, have a hard time figuring out what is the best way forward here, given climate change, but also given the fact that they have limited resources to determine what kind of seeds to buy. And again, you can tap into this massive knowledge that is out there, typically traditional knowledge, but also quite often knowledge that is not really available in a tabular format, in order to actually provide those kinds of use cases, right? And so this is kind of the opportunity that we have, is to really tap into kind of information that is already collected, but can now be made available in ways that are not extractive, but still support very localized use cases that leverage models, but also foundational models, but also augment those models.
So I want to go back to, you know, the opportunities of unstructured data. But, you know, as we were talking, I was thinking about, and this is kind of a silly example, but I was thinking about, you know, sometimes when you watch movies from the 70s or the 80s, the pre-cell phone era, and the entire plot hinges on somebody getting a phone call, you know, or somebody being able to go through an entire warehouse full of boxes, and the incredible effort and toil that it takes to locate and to, you know, find the exact information that you need, and the time, you know, the clock is ticking on whatever that issue is. And it seems that that information access is such an enormous kind of byproduct of the digital age, if we approach it properly, right? If we approach it with intention, and we approach it carefully and responsibly. And so I find that in a way, you know, when we're talking about data governance, not the most typically dramatic topic, but it is so dramatic, because you can, you know, whether it is a crisis, and we've seen many, many films, and of course, you know, sadly experienced many, many crises in this world, where people would have benefited greatly and lives probably would have been saved had we had access to the vast kind of corpus of knowledge, of human knowledge, that is buried in, you know, analog devices or pieces of paper or wherever they may be. So I think that's tremendously, tremendously exciting to think about. At the same time, there's all these sort of, you know, as you were saying, the kind of data that we have been historically used to dealing with is so different now. And of course, for about the last, I don't know, 10 at least years, we've been talking about unstructured data. At first, people were talking about big data, the vast majority of which is unstructured human data, audio files, video files, you know, text, all that stuff. So what are the unique kind of governance challenges around unstructured data?
Yeah, well, a variety of governance, especially as it relates to the source, right? Because one of the key elements that you really need to figure out is that, is this actually where did the information come from, right? So provenance and lineage, and is this anyway, can we use it in alignment with the initial intent, or do we actually know whether that source is trustworthy in ways that we can actually use it, right? So that's kind of a key, I would say, governance challenge that has become more important than ever before. It was always there. Data provenance has always been a key topic and concern. But I think as we are moving into AI and as we are moving into leveraging non-traditional data or unstructured data for augmenting models that then subsequently are supposed to provide very contextual and quite often factual responses, then you better have you better know where the data comes from. Same thing with quality, has never been more important than it is now. And of course, this is the interesting thing here with quality is, of course, that there are different needs of quality for different use cases as it relates to AI, right? And so if you use data for training, for instance, then volume might be actually more important than quality. But when you, for the use cases that we are interested in, which are kind of mainly RAG-based kind of use cases that have, very specific answers to contextual questions, then quality is of the utmost importance, right? Because then you really need to have high quality data in terms of integrity, but also in terms of relevance and in terms of course, alignment with how it was collected. And so so these are kind of two, I would say, governance, data governance areas that have become more important. The other ones are, of course, related to interoperability, because ultimately you talk about connecting and linking data. And for that, of course, you need some kind of interoperability standards that you need to have in place. So those are the kind of data governance stroke data management issues. But then, of course, coming back to the reuse, right? Because typically when you reuse data for other purposes, then you have collected the data, and especially when it involves people and communities, then you have a key governance headache with regard to consent, by which I mean is that typically data was, as you mentioned, Susan, you go to the doctor, you basically have to check a box and consent to the data that is being collected. And typically consent notices basically say, we're going to just use the data for the purpose for which it was collected. And sometimes they will say for research and that kind of stuff, but even that is very hard to figure out. And so we really need to do a better job with consent. And by which I mean is that if we want to start reusing data, we cannot just rely on consent, because it's kind of impossible to then go back and get new consent. And more importantly, individuals quite often have no agency in order to really express what they want the data to be reused for. Because if you would ask people, many actually would have no problem having it being reused for research, for instance, or for areas that actually would benefit society. And so that's where we have been working on this notion of a social license that actually can complement consent, that really takes into account community preferences and expectations, not just individual preferences and expectations, and then embed that in how that data is being reused. And so this is another key, from my point of view, governance challenge. We just published a report where we advocated for reimagining data governance at the time of AI. And the real focus there was actually embedding social license in how we go about reusing that. And that, again, comes back to data commons, because data commons can actually provide access to data in alignment with a social license. And they can say, well, they are actually alignment with preferences.
Well, let's talk about what is a social license. Can you define that for us?
So a social license is just an expression of community expectations and preferences. And that expression doesn't have to be a license, right? But it's an expression that indicates how they want their data to be reused, under what conditions, by whom, and so on. Now, that can be translated. It can be translated into terms of and conditions. It can be translated into data sharing agreements. can be translated in other, in actually a license as well. But we use the term social license because it is a well-established practice in other industries. For instance, in the mining industry, when mining companies want to extract an asset, such as a mineral, there has to be a social license. And typically that means that they work with communities in order to create shared benefits of that extraction. And I think it's also kind of applicable to data, where you can start thinking about how do we create shared benefits, or at least indicate how you want that data to be reused. And of course, it's different, but at the same time, as a concept, I think it's very powerful. And more importantly, it enables you to actually use the data, but it also gives agency to communities and individuals.
Mm, yeah, and that's so complex, especially given all the different, you know, all the data exhaust that we as humans create during the course of our day, right? So one of the things that you had said early on was that you are interested in the ways that generative AI can actually help support the goals of open data. So can you talk about that a little?
Yeah, no, so we are super excited by, anyway, what we call the arrival of the fourth wave of open data, which is where generative AI can actually be used to democratize access to data. Meaning by the fourth wave, anyway, the first wave was really about freedom of information, access to government information upon request. That moved into the second wave of open data, where data was made available on a platform for everyone to use. And then the third wave was really about also having access to private sector data as open data, but also to provide access to data with a purpose, which was different than just hoping that anyone would use it. And so from our point of view, we're now entering the fourth wave of open data, where open data can improve Gen AI, but Gen AI can also be used to improve how we open data and how we access data. By which we mean, for instance, that Gen AI can actually provide a conversational layer with data, so that you don't have to have a data science background. You can actually just ask a question via a chatbot or a conversational interface, and you can actually extract insight from the data in more direct, more human-centric kind of ways as well. And so that's super exciting because it really takes out kind of the transaction cost and the expertise you typically need to make sense of open data, for instance, right? So that's one. Other use cases where Gen AI can actually be used is, for instance, Gen AI can actually provide or make data more high quality, or it can also fill in gaps that you might have in the data that otherwise would make the data not representative. And then we're entering, of course, the field of synthetic data, which is kind of a copy of real data that can be made synthetic, either for protecting privacy, but also quite often and more often nowadays, synthetic data is used to actually fill in gaps in the data so that you actually have a better representation of society in the data as well. And so that's another use case from my point of view, where Gen AI really enables access to sensitive data, but also enables to actually increase the quality and the representation of the data itself.
Yeah, I mean, I think that that issue of synthetic data, and I realize that there are both opportunities and risks with synthetic data, certainly not wanting to amplify gaps that you already have, but, you know, places where you, for danger or other types of reasons or scarcity of data, you just, you know, you don't want to simulate, you know, a hundred or 1,000 car crashes. You don't have access to, for example, certain kinds of diseases that are predominant in children and enough data to understand that. And so you want to have that ability without having to simulate or create something in the world that would actually put people at risk. So I think that's really interesting. And we certainly see a similar kind of move on the private sector around using Gen AI to reason over data and to make that ability to interact with the data much more democratized, much more available and accessible to people. So I guess, what comes with that, though, is that you don't necessarily always know what's underneath. And so there is a little bit of a care that people need to take to understand that, none of these are perfect systems, but they might be moving you in a direction that is really, really positive. You just have to kind of have a sense of what is in the box.
Yeah. And that's why, anyway, the other field we are working on, Susan, is to really reimagine data stewardship as mm-hmm. well. And I think, we need to really start thinking, moving beyond ownership and really actually thinking in terms of stewardship. And so that also means stewarding data for public interest purposes that you otherwise would not think. But it also means stewarding in ways that is obviously responsible. And that also means indeed having a better understanding of kind of new applications, even the use of other privacy enhancing technologies besides, of course, synthetic data, and how that can increase value, but also when is it fit for purpose, right? Because even synthetic data or differential privacy might be very important to do to protect privacy, of course, but for particular use cases, it might actually also lead that no data, no insight can be generated at the level of granularity that is needed, right? And so from my point of view, data stewardship is really to start thinking about what is fit for purpose, right? And so if this is the purpose, what is fit, what is responsible, and how do we actually go about this in ways that generates value, but also prevents harm?
Yeah. No, it's really important. And especially when you think about all the different areas where there has been, we think back to machine learning, which is now a couple of decades old, several decades old. There are places where, for example, financial institutions, you can look at precision versus recall and figure out things like potential, bank fraud or credit card risk or all those types of things, and figure out the exact right sort of quality level or accuracy level that they can live with in order to make sure that they're not putting through, transactions that might be fraudulent that are much more higher value but less known. And so these issues of sort of what those risks look like when you're talking about new uses of data that we have not been working on for 20, 30, 40 years. There's a lot of learning to do. So I guess what you're saying is that data stewardship is not just the sort of the process of shepherding data through in a responsible way, but actually facilitating the process of setting those kind of controls around what do we expect to be fit for purpose for different use cases. And that seems really
interesting. Yeah, no, exactly. You said it better than I did, but it's exactly that kind of also more strategic function, right? Because typically data stewardship was seen as a very tactical kind of either profession or role, but I think it has to become also more strategic in alignment with what are kind of purposes, right, that the data can serve. And how do you then go about that in a ways that is fit for purpose, but also aligned with principles, right? And I think that's the real area. Now, it turns out, Susan, that defining the purpose is equally challenging and not as easy because what we see is that a lot of the efforts and a lot of the kind of stewardship happens by focusing on the supply of data without really understanding what is the possible demand or what are the possible purposes. And so towards that end, we've also been trying to kind of create more of a sophistication and understanding what are possible purposes for and purposes that matter for which you need data. And that's where our work around questions literacy and the new science of questions comes in, because I was on, anyway, working on this. I've been on many panels and on many occasions where everyone says we need more data. But then each time when I asked, so what's the purpose and what's the question, most of the time I had kind of an empty answer or no answer. And that made me realize that we, as a society, we are actually really bad in prioritizing and formulating questions. And so that's when I created something called the 100 Questions Initiative, which is really what are the purposes for which we need data, that if we would have data, we would actually be able to make progress on those questions. And so towards that end, we developed a methodology. But the key lesson of that is that it's not easy. And there is also quite often no literacy with regard to how you go about formulating questions. And so questions literacy has to become part of data stewardship, but also has to become part of basically broader literacy. There's a lot of focus on data literacy, but the value of the data depends on the questions we ask. And so we also need to focus on questions literacy.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I would stand up and share if it weren't, I could just break the flow. Because, you know, this is a conversation I've been having with so many people about, you know, we talk about all the things that AI can do for us. And I think that this also leads us to what do we need to do to be able to make AI function for us in the way we want it to function. And that does mean that we need to get much, much better at asking questions. And, you know, funnily enough, we've talked about this before, that, you know, there's this role of prompt engineer, which may or may not be something that exists into the future. But the idea here is, you know, how do we actually create a discipline and a rigor around asking questions that are going to enable us to get to answers that actually move the needle in some meaningful way? And I actually see this as not only a governance challenge, but it's just or a technology challenge, but just fundamentally a human challenge. Like, how do we as people evolve to be able to use these technologies to the best possible outcome? So I feel like that, you know, I'm really excited about that. I think that's a wonderful approach.
Yeah. And as I said, meaning I think we really need to, well, and also even for prompt engineering, because you mentioned prompt engineering, I mean, I think even for prompt engineering, you actually do need to know how do we optimize, right, models for the questions that matter. and then, of course, the other question is then, and who actually formulates the question? Because part of the challenge that we have in society is what I call questions inequities, which is not everyone, right, has the opportunity to actually formulate the questions that are being answered.
Yeah.
And how do we actually make this more participatory? And how do we also then subsequently, of course, develop prompt engineering applications that actually answer questions for broader audiences that typically might not be anticipated as well? And I think this whole field of questioning is kind of still greenfield, to be quite honest. And also from my point of view, is an area where I think humans have still a unique role to play. And I think that's why we need to have more sophistication in how we go about this. We also need to understand that there are different types of questions.
Yes.
I mean, we developed a taxonomy of questions because, anyway, one question is not the same as the other question, and one question depends on the other question. Because the interesting thing, Susan, about questions is the first part of the name of the word, which is that it's ultimately about a quest, and how do you structure the quest is equally important as what questions are being formulated, right? And I think and that's kind of what I feel like in prompt engineering still not fundamentally embedded, is the kind of the quest of the inquiry. I think that still needs a lot more attention.
Yeah. Well, this is our plug for the sociologists and anthropologists and all the social scientists and the, you know, the critical thinkers and all of those to help us kind of, you know, come to questions that are actually meaningful for all the different domains in which we can use these technologies and use this data. So, Stefan, thank you. This has been a wonderful, wonderful conversation. I'm so, so happy that you were able to join. Is there any last bit of advice you have for our listeners in terms of like how they can learn more, do more?
No, well, I think, as I said, I mean, the real issue is to, anyway, how do we make access to data for reuse more systematic, sustainable, and responsible? That, from my perspective, is the real challenge in today's data and AI age. And I think towards that end, we really need to become better in A, formulating the demand, and that's where question science comes in, B, improving the supply, which also means, anyway, increasing quality, but also having a better understanding of provenance and ultimately how do we go about different types of supply. And then, of course, Susan, it's really about how do we then match demand and supply in ways that are both responsible and systematic. And that's, again, where data commons comes in. And so, as you know, together with Microsoft, we've launched a challenge around establishing data commons. And the whole idea here was to really spur innovation in that space, because I do think that we need a lot more innovation in how we match demand and supply in ways that is responsible, but also systematic. And I think if any of your listeners are interested in experimenting, but also in learning how to go about this, we would be eager to be of any support.
Wonderful. Well, thank you so, so much. Really, really appreciate all your insights and your passion for data innovation.
Thanks so much for having me, Susan.
Wow. I am still spinning on this conversation. There's so much to think about, but I'll tell you what kind of resonates for me and where I end up with this whole question about data governance. You know, you hear that phrase and it sounds dry. What's underneath it is so important, though. We have been given this technology, set of technologies that's so incredibly powerful. And we are at a point in our history where we're digitizing so much information. And we don't want to leave people behind, and we don't want to use data that we shouldn't be using in ways we shouldn't be using it. But on the other side, there is this opportunity to really start to deeply understand things that we probably couldn't understand before. And certainly data is not the only thing, right? We need to interpret it. We need to analyze it. We need the context. We need the human understanding in addition to the data, whatever form it comes in. But what it really comes down to is this. Stefan said that there are 100 questions he's been working on. Think about how many questions there are for you, how many questions there are for the people that you love. What are the things that we want to understand to make our lives better, our kids' lives better, and the world better? And in order to do that, we have to take this extraordinarily sensitive data and we have to use it in ways that we can get the value out of it, get the benefit out of it, and also do that in a way that's safe and repeatable and open and transparent. So that's kind of where I end up, is on this question of what can we do and how should we do it? And as technology continues and as these technologies get more powerful, I think that's also our responsibility too, to get more powerful as well and really more intentional about how we think about and how we use data. So thanks for listening. We will see you next time. Susan out. We hope you've enjoyed this episode. And as I'm sure you know, new podcasts live and die on engagement. So please like, comment, share, tell your friends, and let us know what you'd like to hear about. We're listening. If you'd like to learn more about how people and organizations are innovating with Microsoft Azure, visit azure.microsoft.com. The Leading the Shift podcast is a place for experts to share their insights and opinions. As students of the future of technology, Microsoft values inputs from a diverse set of voices. That said, the opinions and findings of our guests are their own, and they may not necessarily reflect Microsoft's own research or positions. Leading the Shift is a production of Microsoft Azure. I'm your host, Susan Ettlinger. Our executive producers are Haley Meehan, Aaron Russell, Eric Williams, and me. Production support provided by the incredible team at Indigo Slate.